On the 14th of June 2017, a fire broke out on the fourth floor of the Grenfell Tower. It quickly engulfed the building, thanks to some flammable cladding on the exterior, and 72 people died in the fire. The images of the fire, in which the building looked like a giant candle, were not only reminiscent of 9/11, but they raised questions about how this could possibly have happened and what needed to happen to prevent a fire like this happening again. Now, here in Australia, in response to Grenfell, there are buildings having their cladding replaced, including here at the ABC. Planning approval processes have come under scrutiny, whilst in Sydney there have now been two residential towers that have been evacuated after structural cracks were detected. Now, to find out how the survivors of Grenfell are coping and what progress is being made to ensure it doesn't happen again, we're pleased to welcome Rob Booth to the program. Rob's been covering the Grenfell fire for 2 years and has written extensively on it and its aftermath. He's the social affairs correspondent for The Guardian and joins us on the blower from London. Rob, welcome.
Hi.
2 years on the case. Have you been, has it changed you?
Well, I suppose it certainly had an impact. Covering the Grenfell Tower fire for that long, you get to know quite well some of the people that survived the fire and some of those that were bereaved by the fire. And you get to see them going through not only some of their own sort of personal pain and anguish, but also trying to campaign really for change and to ensure that it doesn't happen again, but also for justice for themselves. So, you know, it is one of those stories that you cover when you're working on it. There's, you know, often moments when it's very emotional. For example, covering the public inquiry that was going on for large parts of last year, the first phase of that, still not finished. You know, there was a moment almost every day, I think, when evidence was being given that, you know, you would feel somewhat teary because of the impact of what's gone on for that community.
Let's remind the listener of the facts of the fire, how it started, and why so many people died. Of course, it begins in a fridge, doesn't it, on a fourth floor flat.
That's right. The fire seemed to begin behind a fridge freezer in that flat, and then that was occupied by a taxi driver and a couple of other people, and they managed to evacuate. But the flames burst through, it seems, the window frame, the UPVC window frame, which had seemed to have melted. They got out and they got into the cladding system, and then within about less than half an hour, the fire started, broke out at about 12:54 a.m. So after midnight, and within about an hour, the flames were all the way to the less than half an hour, in fact, the flames were all the way to the top of the building, all the way to the 24th floor. So that one side of the building was engulfed, and then it didn't take much longer for the other sides to catch as the fire spread. They think it spread around the crown of the building, which is a sort of architectural feature that had been installed during the refurbishment around the top of the building, and caught the other sides of the building as well.
I think it's important to recall that 999 was telling people to stay put long after they should have left.
Well, that seems to be the conclusion so far from the first phase of the inquiry, that the stay put policy, which is based around the idea that the fire should be kept in a compartment, essentially within one flat unit, that flat would burn out and everyone else would be safe, that was very quickly redundant. And I think there was, if I remember rightly, I don't think the stay put policy was changed until about 2:48 in the morning. And by that time, many people unfortunately had stayed put and had died.
Let's also recall that there were concerns about the refurbishment of Grenfell from its residents long before the fire.
That's right. There were concerns on a number of levels, partly because it was the builders were sort of super inconsiderate, and there was a lot of antagonism between the builders who were making the changes and the residents, but also because the residents had raised lots of concerns about the way the new gas pipes were being installed and safety concerns, and that they felt that they weren't being heeded properly by their landlord, which is essentially a council landlord. And there was a group of them who established a blog called the Grenfell Action Blog, and they wrote on that blog about their concerns, including warning that the only thing that was really, this was 7 months before the fire, the only thing that was really going to wake people up to the indifference, if you like, of their landlords to their complaints was something that was catastrophic, and there was a quite remarkable prediction made on that blog by Ed Daffan, the author of it and a resident of the building.
Tell us more about Ed, because he's a very significant part of the story.
Ed is 56. He's born and brought up in that part of West London, Notting Hill. He had a kind of colourful background, I suppose. He was a kind of punk in the 70s and 80s, when The Clash and bands like that were playing in the area. He spent a bit of time in New York, living there and on the kind of music scene. And then he comes back to the UK and eventually trains as a mental health social worker, and lives in Grenfell Tower from 2001. While he's there, he's looking after his elderly parents, working as a mental health social worker, but also becoming increasingly concerned about the way that the council and the landlord are treating the tenants in the block. So it becomes something of a kind of local activist, really. And it was Ed who, with others in the immediate aftermath of the fire, having escaped, realised that the community needed to organise, not just to sort out its own kind of immediate response to things like food and housing and security for the people that were escaping from the building, but also to mount a longer term political campaign to make sure this never happened again. And that's kind of Ed's story.
There were conspiracy theories at the time. One of them, I recall, was that the residents had lit the fire themselves.
Well, there's no evidence of that at all.
Well, of course not, but it nonetheless, it did energise some pretty nasty attitudes.
Well, I think some of the attitudes that emerged around the time of the fire about who was living in the block were rooted in ignorance, and there was there was rhetoric around the fact that it was there was lots of legal immigrants living in the block, the idea that there are lots of people on benefits in the block. There was almost a kind of a sense that this was a very marginal community that we perhaps shouldn't care too much about from some quarters. And of course, that turns out to be wrong. It was to do with it reflected a sort of broader prejudice about people who live in council housing that there has been in the UK for some time. But that response seemed also to be a part of that kind of coldness, I suppose, was evidenced in the way that the Prime Minister Theresa May had responded in the first few days of the fire, because she didn't get down there for a couple of days, and then she was roundly criticised for showing a lack of empathy at that point.
We'll come back to May a little later. In the first few days after the fire, great difficulties. No one seemed to be taking charge, and the residents were understandably angry.
That's right. They talk about there being no one in a high vis and with a clipboard on the ground in those first few hours to gather names of people who'd survived and tally up those who were missing, presumed dead. And they, it was a chaotic scene. The community centres and churches threw open their doors in the middle of the night. survivors were in there. There were lots of kind of well wishers and people bringing essentials like food and water and clothing to try and help. And that happened for the first few days. But what became very apparent to some of the survivors and the bereaved was that they were going to have to organize their response themselves. And that's exactly what they started to do within days of the fire. They started to try and put together a kind of community organization which could represent their interests and also set forth, if you like, the changes that they knew that they were going to have to campaign for.
Let's go back to Teresa. She promised that all the residents would be rehoused in 3 weeks, but 2 years later, what's the state?
Well, there is still, I think, one household living in a hotel. By the first Christmas, there were over 100 households still living in hotels, so the three-week promise didn't come good. And it's been a slow process, but most families, the large majority of families now have got somewhere permanent to live. The fact that those promises were made and then broken was one of the things that eroded trust in the government's response.
Rob, I imagine there was a sharp intake of Boothian breath when in her resignation speech she claimed a response to Grenfell was one of her major achievements.
Yes, I think there was a sense in which she liked to think of herself as on the side of the sort of hard-working people. She talked about that as well in her first speech as Prime Minister, being on the side of the just about managings. And she clearly did in the end empathise with the members of Grenfell United and those people in the organisation who she would meet on reasonably regularly in the following years and months. But her government's actions in terms of responding to it were nowhere near the way that she saw her own abilities on this front.
Talking to Rob Booth, social affairs correspondent at The Guardian, on the occasion of the second anniversary of the Grenfell disaster. May announced a full inquiry at the time. I understand that the first phase is completed, but no report yet.
That's right. It's a huge disappointment to the survivors and bereaved who thought that there was going to be a first phase report, which is essentially going to deal with what happened on the night of the fire and the whole issue that we've been talking about how it spread and the stay put policy and the firefighters' response. They thought that that was going to come out on prior to the anniversary, and they were only told, I think, in May, so last month, that in fact it's all rather complicated and we won't be able to get you a report out until October. And also that the second phase of the inquiry, which for many is the most important phase, isn't going to start until the beginning of next year. And that phase will look at the lead up to the fire, the decisions that were made in terms of the refurbishment and the redevelopment of Grenfell Tower, and how come so much combustible materials wrapped around it, and how come so much of the works were appeared to be faulty and put lives at risk.
Rob, has any person or organisation been charged over the deaths?
No, there is a parallel Metropolitan Police Scotland Yard investigation, criminal investigation, which is pointed towards examining breaches of health and safety law, possible manslaughter, possible corporate manslaughter charges. However, there haven't been any charges yet, and there aren't going to be any charges until after the second phase of the inquiry comes back with a report. So that doesn't look likely to be until at least 2021. A number of people, a small number of people, have been interviewed under caution, but it is getting very frustrating for many of the bereaved survivors that there is such slow progress on the path to justice.
You describe Grenfell United, this community organisation, growing in cohesion and clarity of mission.
That's exactly it. And that the clarity of their mission seemed to come into focus quite quickly because two things, really. One was that Ed Daffan and others had were very aware that there were institutional failings within the council and the landlord, that they knew kind of were behind some of what happened at the fire, but also because of the way that the response took place, it was so shambolic that there was that reinforced a sense of them being left on their own. So that kind of mission was a strong, clear purpose early on. And as they gathered over the following weeks and months, members and the committee was established, they started to form the basics of an institution, which is the way I see it, is that they formed an institution to fill the void where other institutions had failed them. And they started to campaign on things like, you know, they were doing casework on things like housing, you know, essentially doing the work that local councillors would normally do, make sure people were rehoused, make sure their benefit forms were filled out right. But they were also addressing issues like how far the public inquiry, they would be able to be involved in the public inquiry. So they were wrestling with big legal frameworks like that, also with inquests into the people that died, and starting to tackle the politicians over these broader issues about the way that social housing tenants are perceived in this country.
I wish we had a lot more time, but I want you to tell me a little about Natasha Elcock, another major player, and by all measures seems to be quite remarkable.
Natasha was brought up in and around Grenfell Tower, lived in Grenfell Tower for a long time, a mother of three. She was stuck inside the tower until just before 4 o'clock in the morning. So she was one of the last survivors to get out. And when she did get out with her young daughter and her partner, who were in the flat at the time, the flames were already coming through the kitchen window. And so she was very lucky to get out. She did lose an uncle who lived on a floor above her. She's a supermarket manager, and she became the chairwoman of Grenfell United last year. And she's been leading this organization, mixing, having meetings with the Prime Minister, with dashing away from her shift at work and looking after her family. So she's a remarkable person, and she is in it for the long run. She said to me that she wants to stay involved in this campaign all the way through, and that means she's committed to several more years of campaigning and keeping her community together.
We've discovered in Australia that there are many people living in properties covered in combustible cladding. That is also, of course, the case in the UK. And it's not just Grenfell residents who are angry about the inaction on fire safety.
That's right. There's still 146 private tower blocks that are...
I'm sorry, 146?
146. That's privately owned tower blocks that still have the similar Grenfell style cladding on them, the aluminium composite material cladding on them, and the rate of those being fixed is very slow. Over the last 4 months, only three have been remediated, and there's also about 100 social housing blocks which are yet to be fixed. The progress of fixing the social housing blocks has been quite a lot faster. There's been more money made available to them by the government, and they've moved a bit quicker, but there's tens of thousands of people who are still living in blocks that are wrapped in this sort of material. And it's meant that, you know, some residents have been mounting their own waking watches, walking through the night the corridors of their own towers to make sure that fires aren't starting. It's causing enormous anxiety and upset, and of course there's a huge financial implication, because people who own these flats are finding that they're not worth what they used to be. And so things like moving jobs, if you want to sell your flat, you can't do it. It's having a whole range of different impacts on society over here.
Robert, thank you very much for your time. Robert Booth, Social Affairs Correspondent for The Guardian.